Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We begin the show with Colonel Vindman. In the fall of 2019, when he was testifying before the impeachment hearing, it was powerful testimony, it was emotional testimony, and when he got done, I was proud to be an American, because he was one. And yet what he said was, "Don't worry, Dad, you did the right thing by coming here. I will be all right. It will be all right." And of course, what we know is it wasn't all right for Colonel Vindman. It wasn't all right for his brother. And frankly, it's not all right for the rest of us. So now the powerful words of Colonel Vindman in 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I have a professor from Georgia State Law School. Again, where do I go? Theconversation.com. But he also sends me a sort of a similar article along the same theme from the Regulatory Review. Only Arnie Arneson, like the crazy wonk, would be like, "Oh my God, the Regulatory Review." But the topic was, I think, very important. We touched on it, Ken Barnes, on Monday with our Rethink the Week. But you go into depth with this, and I want to thank Timothy Lighton for doing this, because the title of the piece at the Regulatory Review was, "Businesses that reopen too soon should be subject to tort liability." Now, under the photo at the Regulatory Review, which is going to explain why I'm going to go to my Twitter feed and read you something before we get into your article, says the following: "Conflicting signals from public officials about when and how to restart the economy following the COVID-19 shutdown hardly inspires confidence." And I read that and I went, "Oh." And then, Tim, I happened to be looking at my Twitter feed, and I'm going to share with you the following thread, because in a lot of ways, it talks about the fact that confusion, not confidence, is ruling the day. Mark Joseph Stern wrote the following. He writes for Slate.com. He is a regular on this radio program. And it begins this way: "Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley, a Republican, just described the governor's stay-at-home order as, quote, the very definition of tyranny, close quote. He then continues, "Yeah, the Republicans on the Wisconsin Supreme Court are going to strike down Governor Evers' stay-at-home order. And they're going to do it after oral arguments and conference held on Zoom so they don't personally risk coronavirus infection. And Justice Daniel Kelly, who just lost his seat by a huge margin and is now a lame duck, is likely to join the majority in invalidating the stay-at-home order. Justice Rebecca Bradley, a Republican, just compared Governor Evers' stay-at-home order to the forced Japanese internment order upheld in Korematsu." Oh my God. "Justice Bradley, who is now comparing Wisconsin's stay-at-home order to tyranny and Japanese internment, is a Federalist Society member who previously served as president of the Milwaukee chapter and regularly appears at Federalist Society events. She is a sort of prototype Trump judge. Justice Daniel Kelly just referred to his colleague, Justice Rebecca Dallet, as Mrs. Dallet. FYI, Justice Daniel Kelly and Rebecca Bradley, both Republicans, opposed the court's order suspending jury trials in non-criminal cases due to COVID-19. They claimed suspending trials was not necessary to protect the public. Finally, Assistant Attorney General Colin Roth is trying to remain patient and polite, but the Republican justices are being so horrible that he's getting a little frustrated. It occurs to me that this is what it's going to be like litigating before Trump judges for the next 50 years. He goes on and on and on, which I will at this point refuse to do. But I just thought about this, and as I was looking at your article and talking about the failure to understand what guidance we are getting from our politicians, the story coming out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court as we begin this conversation, it makes me afraid that what Mitch McConnell wants and Donald Trump wants, which is to basically sort of let companies off the hook from protecting their employees, and that with all this confusion going on, I'm not even sure what kind of guidance these companies should be looking for, since no one seems to be looking at anything that even represents something called guidance or a standard. So let me welcome you to the program, and let's talk about what's being floated up the food chain, because I am terrified about what it means for the health and safety of workers.
Well, there are, as you mentioned in your comments, a lot of political crosswinds at the moment, and there are governors and states that are moving more towards extending restrictions, and there are governors and states that are moving to remove them. A lot of them are doing so based on relatively weak data. Here in Georgia, our governor is moving relatively quickly to open the economy and kind of restart business as usual. The problem is we don't really have the public health information we would need to know how that's going to turn out. So to some degree, there's a certain amount of guesswork involved. I think some of it's irreducible guesswork. Nobody knows exactly what the future will hold. But we're better off when policy is made on the basis of sort of clear data. In the absence of that sort of data, we have states with widely differing approaches to this. And for a small business owner looking to reopen a restaurant or a store or a gymnasium or a health club, this has become increasingly confused. It's very hard to know where it is one's supposed to look to for guidance. And that's really where I think that tort immunity debate comes in. If you open a store in the age of COVID and you don't take reasonable precautions to protect your customers or your employees, at the moment, you're subject to liability for any harm that they might suffer. That's because anytime a person undertakes an activity or conducts business and they don't do so with reasonable care and they injure other people, they're responsible to make good on that and compensate the other people. So if you're a small business owner and you're opening up, you need to think about, what do I need to do to avoid a lawsuit for improper care in terms of opening my restaurant or my bowling alley or my business?
Exactly.
And the standards of care in the law are actually clearer than the standards we're getting from public authorities these days. The standards of tort liability are essentially that a person has to exercise reasonable care. And what that means in the law is you have to take cost-effective precautions like masks and gloves and social distancing. You have to follow state guidance and regulation insofar as public health authorities are putting out for public health reasons and not political reasons. You have to keep up with industry standards and see what other businesses in your area are doing. And you have to exercise common sense. And if you do those things, you're essentially shielded from liability. What Mitch McConnell and the business community would like to do is to create immunity from that kind of liability exposure. And I think that immunity is essentially going to take away the one guidepost of certainty that businesses have to try and figure out what types of precautions they need to take and how much is enough in order to reopen in an age where they're getting conflicting signals from public authorities.
But aren't they also suggesting that there will be frivolous lawsuits and that, yes, you know, basically this reasonable standard is something that should be understood, but you know how litigious we are as a society and someone will do it. So what you're doing is the potential for harassing certain businesses, for creating sort of this sort of havoc. And therefore, since nobody really quite understands, I'll be honest with you, I understand what your statement about reasonable standard. I'm not sure what the hell a reasonable standard is for a hairdresser. I'm not sure what a reasonable standard is for a meat packer. I'm not sure. I mean, even as we talk about this, isn't that definition of reasonable standard kind of elastic based on what we know now, based on what we're going to know a month from now, based on whether I'll give you another example. So I just looked at an order coming out from my governor in New Hampshire. We are awash in PPEs. Why are we on a wash in PPEs? Because we have a very, very rich guy named Dean Kamen who went to China, I think it was, and brought back millions and millions of masks and protective. He is offering to every business basically access to PPEs. If you want to open your business, so that means they don't have to worry about buying it. They don't have to worry about the cost benefit analysis because he's willing to give it to them. In Georgia, I'm sure the governor of Georgia isn't saying, here's the PPEs, just use them. So even when you're looking at a reasonable standard, it almost feels like it's going to be geography specific, whether there's availability of PPEs in one state and not in another state. And I guess that's where maybe what Mitch McConnell is trying to do, I'm not defending him, but what he's trying to do is say, because it is such a roller coaster, is that fair to business when what they want is some idea of what is the standard? And since the standard is going to differ, should it differ based on geography? Should it differ based on access to, like, the PPEs we're talking about?
You know, I think that what you point out, the idea that the reasonable care standard will differ depending on whether you're a hairdresser or a restaurant owner or a health club operator, is exactly the reason why it works so well. That is, we don't know from a global perspective what the safest way is to operate a hairdressing salon or to operate a health club. The governor doesn't know that, and public health authorities know that. If you want to know the best person to ask about reasonable precautions to protect your patrons from infection for a hairdresser, the best person to ask is a hairdresser. Why? Because a hairdresser knows what the costs and benefits are of gloves or masks for their employees or for their customers. They know what the costs and benefits are for reducing density of customers in that salon at any given time. They know what the regulations are that govern their specific business and what the guidance is from public health authorities. They know what the standards are for hairdressers in the area better than any public official does. And they know what common sense means from the point of view of being a hairdresser. So the tort reasonable care standard is decentralized, and that's precisely its beauty. It lets people decide what reasonable care requires, who are best qualified. And who are those people? The hairdressers operating hair salons, the restaurateurs operating restaurants, and the health club owners operating health clubs. We don't need Mitch McConnell or the governor of the state of Georgia or any other governor to tell a hairdresser what is reasonable care required to prevent the transmission of COVID in your business. We need hairdressers to figure that out. And the incentive that they have to do that is that they face liability if they don't pick their heads up, look around, and figure out what those standards are in their industry.
Okay, amen.
Can I just put this in some perspective, Arnie, because I don't think the public debate is aware of why we have tort liability in the first place. You know, in a state of nature, if everybody is free to go about their business, then everybody can go do what they want to do. But me taking certain actions can cause harm to you. Me polluting upriver can cause harm downriver. Me stepping on your toes hurts you. That's why we have law and order, and in particular law. And that's what all tort law is it says, if everybody is acting reasonably and taking into consideration other folks and not exercising my rights as if I'm the only guy that has any rights, but I'm recognizing that I'm not stepping on other people's rights as well, then you're acting reasonably and that's fine. And if I act unreasonably, if I drive all over the road and go bouncing off of other cars, I'm not reasonably careful, then I'm not acting reasonably and I can be liable for any damage that I cause to other people who are on the road. That's the whole point of tort liability. So we're not making public policy by saying businesses should be subject to tort liability if they act not acting with reasonable care. All we're saying is they have to be reasonably careful. And
let me ask you a question.
Figuring
here,
out what that takes, Tim is right. That's what individual actors do.
Well, and
you don't shield them from liability.
And what you're saying is that the beauty of this is that it really is sort of industry specific, or it is geographically specific, or it can look at the time in which the event happened. Because, you know, 6 months from now, we may have more information than we did at the time she gave the haircut. But you don't judge it based on 6 months later. You base it on the time she gives the haircut. So let me ask another question, because the public official stuff is making me crazy. And what I was just reading to you from the Wisconsin Supreme Court makes me even more crazy. To even suggest comparing this to Korematsu is unbelievable. But is there also a difference between an employer's responsibility to protecting their worker, which means that they have to look at the density issues, they have to look at just all the sort of complications of the workplace, versus me deciding I want to get a haircut? Have I decided that I am willing to take or assume some risk because I know that COVID-19 is easily transferable? I know that probably it's going to be a little bit of a challenge for my haircutter to really kind of protect me and hermetically seal me from COVID-19. Is there a difference in what is expected of an employer to an employee versus what is expected of the owner of a business to me, who knows kind of with knowledge the risk I'm taking going into that grocery store or that haircutter?
Yeah, the law essentially protects consumers of businesses or patrons of businesses differently than it protects employees of businesses. Okay. When we're talking about a consumer, in order for a consumer to sue a store that they go into or a restaurant that they eat at for COVID-19 transmission, that consumer would have to show first that the restaurant didn't exercise reasonable care, they weren't using masks or gloves or other things that would have been cost effective or that are required, you know, by industry standards. But second, they'd have to prove that they got COVID in the restaurant because of that lack of care. It's going to be very hard for people to pinpoint where they contracted the disease sometime between 3 and 11 days ago. So we're not likely to see a lot of people, even against restaurants or businesses that are careless, being able to bring these lawsuits. And finally, the point you raise is that you cannot sue a person if you assume the risk of getting injured. So if you walk into a restaurant and you see the servers are not wearing masks or using gloves or other patrons are sitting too close, and you sit down and order your meal anyway and you contract COVID, you're not going to be able to recover because you can't bring a lawsuit if you assume the risk.
Okay.
That's the story right. for the patron.
Right.
It's different in a business because in a business, you may have economic pressures that require you to go to work. So it's not like a free choice of going in and ordering your meal. When your boss says, you either show up, mask or no mask, or you're going to get fired, you are going to be under pressure to show up. And on that basis, it's a different case. But keep in mind, workers are covered by something different than tort liability. They're covered by workers' compensation. If you're injured on the job, you no longer have rights to sue your employer for negligence the way you would if you were a patron of the business. But in exchange, the state has given you the right to workers' compensation insurance, which means instead of having to litigate or go to court, you can simply file a claim that I was injured at work. And because I was injured at work, you can get what's essentially an insurance payment to pay your medical costs. But there's no lawsuit involved. The problem here is that workers' compensation statutes generally cover injuries suffered at work, but they exclude any kind of illness that it is that the general public is subject to. So if you catch the flu at work, workers' compensation doesn't cover you. Now, you wouldn't sue for catching the flu at work, but you might sue for catching COVID-19 at work. And if you catch COVID-19 at work, there is a good chance that your state's workers' compensation statute does not cover you. And that means that you now are allowed to sue in torts. Because workers' compensation says that it's an exclusive remedy. If you get the workers' compensation payment, you can't sue. But where workers' compensation doesn't pay, it's open season on the employer. And so we're likely to see more suits by employees who are pressured to come to work by employers who are not using reasonable care because there's no assumption of the risk defense there than we are patron lawsuits where people generally are going to be assuming the risk of going in as a customer into that store. So I think if we're going to see a lot of lawsuits, they're more likely to come out of the employment context than they are to come out of the patron or consumer context.
Wow, this is fascinating, Tim. I love you. So as I'm thinking about this, the other thing I'm also thinking about is that in some states, what governors are saying is that if I open up a business and you are concerned about going to work, you will not be able to collect unemployment compensation if you decide not to go to work because of your concern about contracting COVID-19. In that situation, who the frick are you suing? your employer might say, well, you're not coming to work. But this is where even the unemployment potential of being able to collect is being denied you, but it's not being denied you because your employer didn't let you go. It's being denied you because the public officials are saying, no, we're making you go. That puts you in a real catch-22.
Well, if you're not subject to the defense of assumption of the risk, if you're an employee who's pressured to go to work, that essentially means unless your employer provides reasonable precautions in that workplace, they may be subject to a lawsuit by you for negligence. Now, unless there's some executive order from the governor that they're not allowed to use precautions, they have to use precautions. And if they don't use precautions and you're injured and you're pressured to go to work and it's not really a fully voluntary decision to show up for work and you're exposed and you get COVID-19 and you get sick, then you may be able to bring a lawsuit against that employer. Now, the employers are worried about this. My advice would be, first of all, for employers to make sure that you keep on top of what public health officials are saying. What are the costs and benefits of different things that you can do to protect your workers? What are the standards in your industry? And basically common sense. Now, if it comes to the point where employers are really caught between a rock and a hard place where there are lawsuits being brought that are, you know, they're not insured in order to defend against, we may need to see some sort of protection for small businesses. But we haven't seen that yet. And I think that the specter of a flood of lawsuits is the sort of type of worry or anxiety that the business community always brings out when they're looking for ways to scale back the civil justice system and people's rights to sue. So I think until we see a real problem, I wouldn't project that there's going to be a problem into the future.
Again, I'm going to go back to that first line in your piece that we're getting confusing sort of statements coming out of public officials and even health officials about what to do. I mean, I'm looking at states that are opening. And originally, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Burke said 14 days, you see this declining, yada, yada, yada. Not one frickin' state has met the standard established by the Trump administration and Dr. Fauci. So the question I then have is, which standard are we looking at? Do I get to pick the standard that fits best with my company? Like, I want the weakest standard with the least likely to sort of maybe protect my workers because I found one official or one health official who said this should work. And that's the other problem. It's not just the public officials that seem to be disagreeing. It even seems to be the health officials. And you can sort of cherry pick your official in order to sort of protect your establishment. Is there a reason for legislation to be introduced, not to limit their liability, but legislation that should be introduced that gives some level of at least a threshold that must be met by businesses? I understand it may be different for a beauty salon than it will be for a meatpacking, but my fear is that you find the official that sort of comports with what you ultimately want to do or not want to do.
So I think there are a couple different issues here. One is the question of how soon you should open your business. And it seems to be that there are a lot of different indicators and signals coming out about timing. One day Donald Trump says he's going to, you know, suggest that people shelter in place all the way through the middle of the May. And the next minute he's telling the attorney general to go and defend people who are protesting armed at state houses to stop the shutdown immediately.
So exactly.
As far
good
as
people.
As far as the conflicting signals going in terms of how soon to open, I think that's the kind of thing that there will not be lawsuits about because there is no determinate standard. There's no way a hairdresser or a restaurant is ever going to be able to figure out is, should I open this week or next week? Has the curve flattened enough? That's the kind of issue that there's really no basic common sense standard on. It's the kind of thing that's left to the political branches of government because there are legitimate debates about that. And that's something that I think will not affect employers or, you know, business owners, because I don't think that they're subject to liability for opening too soon or too late. Too soon or too late, there's no way to measure that. As for whether or not we need a statute or legislation or regulation that says you must do X in your business, we already have health codes. We already have guidance from public health authorities in every state. The law of torts, the law of liability that enables you to sue does not require the legislature to do anything. You have those rights from the get-go. And those rights basically say that any person who fails to use common sense, who fails to take cost-effective precautions, who doesn't follow the advice of their trade association or of the local public health officials is opening themselves up to a lawsuit. But if they do those things, then even if it doesn't work, and even if you get sick, the law only requires that the business exercise reasonable care, common sense, follow the guidelines of local public health authorities. And if you do that, you can immunize yourself from liability. But if you don't, you're on notice that you could get in trouble and you should not be in such a race to basically, you know, reopen your business willy-nilly, regardless of what it might cost other people. It's basically a sort of a flag or a warning system. It makes people mindful. It says, slow down enough to take stock of what's going on around you and just get with the program. If you're not a slacker, you're safe. And if you're a slacker, it could cost you.
Get this guy on Rachel Maddow. Get this guy on CNBC. It makes so much sense because I've heard so many friends say, oh yeah, Mitch McConnell's probably right. You know, we don't understand the situation. I mean, we need to protect these people. We're all working in a very precarious setting. And what you just explained shows that tort liability understands this. It is elastic for this. It is industry specific for this. That's the beauty of it, is that it gets it. What most people don't know is it does get it, but you explained it so well. Please, please get on a huge bully pulpit. And I want to share this tape with everyone. We are talking with Timothy Lighton. He is a distinguished university professor of law at Georgia State University, where he teaches regulatory policy, administrative law, and torts. Well, I want to go back to school just to have you as my professor. Thank you so much for this. And I just hope more and more people listen to you. I think it'll give guidance to employers who right now are terrified. And I think you need to remind them of what they need to do and the standard they need to meet. And I think it'll give the rest of us the understanding that what Mitch McConnell wants to do makes no sense under this situation. It basically sort of says we're all even more vulnerable if he gets away with what he wants. And that's not the point of responding to this pandemic. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Lighten. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Stay healthy. Stay safe.
Yeah, you too. All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. And we're talking about, I think, the military budget and climate change. I love this show. Stick around.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you leave frozen food sitting out on the counter for too long, it starts to thaw, and it will eventually rot. The same goes for plant and animal remains that have long been trapped in frozen Arctic soil called permafrost. Brendan Kelly directs a collaborative program called the Study of Environmental Arctic Change.
A quarter of the lands in the Northern Hemisphere are underlain by permafrost, ground that's perpetually frozen, has been in many cases for thousands of years.
That permafrost stores an enormous amount of carbon because it holds so much organic matter. But as the climate warms, some permafrost is starting to thaw.
As that ground thaws, all of a sudden, microorganisms become active and they degrade that plant matter, that animal matter in the soil. And in that degradation process, it releases carbon dioxide and methane to the atmosphere.
That speeds up global warming, which could cause even more permafrost to thaw, accelerating the dangerous cycle. Kelly says it's just one example of how the Arctic can affect the global climate.
The Arctic is seemingly, to a lot of people's mind, is just this distant, not very consequential part of the world, but it turns out it's hugely consequential.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org. Imagine there's no country. It isn't hard.
Welcome back to Part Deux of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. There was a piece I saw that was entitled, No Warming, No War, How Militarism Fuels the Climate Crisis and Vice Versa. And joining us right now are two of the women that are involved in this project. They have written a lot about the whole sort of military budget and where the money is going and what we're disinvesting in. And then they obviously make the connection to climate change, which I think is so important. So let me explain who my two guests are, and then I'm going to open by reading a couple of sentences from their piece at the National Priorities Project. Joining us right now is Lindsay Koshgarian. She is the program director at this organization, and she writes about work on the federal budget and military spending. Lucky us, she's appeared on NPR, the BBC, and CNN. And she got her start as a clinic worker and organizer at Planned Parenthood, yes, yay, and led economic development and affordable housing studies at the University of Massachusetts Donahue Institute prior to joining the National Policy Project in 2014. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much. And Laura Steichen is the outreach coordinator for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And she has helped facilitate collaborations with climate change, focusing organizations on shifting our war economy to address the climate crisis. Totally appropriate because money goes to die at the Pentagon. I was just looking at an article a couple months ago.
And to killing.
And to killing. Well, yeah, it's a double entendre when you say go to die. But there was a story that came out that said that over the course of 1 year, they had moved around a couple of trillions of dollars within the Pentagon budget. They were moving around trillions of dollars. And I'm going, huh. I wonder what they didn't move around, if they could move around trillions of dollars. But let's begin with the piece that's entitled Fighting for a U.S. Federal Budget, that prioritizes peace, economic security, and shared prosperity, looking at how militarism fuels the climate crisis. And it begins this way. The COVID-19 pandemic has utterly changed life as we know it, but it has also laid bare how Washington's militaristic budget priorities have left the country woefully unprepared for a crisis. With massive shortages in public health resources and shocks to the broader economy throwing Americans off their health care, states are left clamoring for help from the military to cope. All this could be a preview of shocks to come as our climate crisis continues unabated. You then continue, while meaningful climate action has stalled on Capitol Hill and in the White House, planners at the Pentagon have been quietly preparing a militarized response to climate chaos for years. Unfortunately, the tendency to understand climate change as just another national security issue has misdirected resources away from the programs we need to mitigate and adapt to a warming climate. And then you explain what your report lays out. We lay out how militarism and the climate crisis are deeply intertwined and mutually reinforcing. The military itself, we explained, is a huge polluter and is often deployed to sustain the very extractive industries that destabilize our economy and our climate. This climate chaos, in turn, leads to massive displacement, militarized borders, and the prospect of further conflict. True climate solutions, we argue, must have anti-militarism at their core. So as I'm reading your piece, so Lindsay, I was reading this, and I need to sort of maybe confess to you something that happened. A couple of years ago, we had a campaign for president in New Hampshire. This is in the 2016 campaign. And what was his name? Martin O'Malley? I think it was Martin O'Malley who was running at the time. He only ran for about 6 hours. But anyway, Martin O'Malley was running for office. And he was waxing poetic about climate change. And afterwards, and he sounded very sort of earthy, crunchy. And I went up to his staff after he spoke and I said, "You need to muscle up." And he goes, "Excuse me?" I said, "Yeah, you need to start quoting from all these Pentagon papers that talk about climate change. Because guess what? It's not just the environmentalists that understand that climate change is real, that it's going to have a huge consequence on stability and on sort of how we interact in the world, but it reinforces that what you are suggesting is not only so real, but the Pentagon is even preparing for it." And so the very next day, guess what? He said that. Okay, I was like so proud. And then of course he got, you know, poo-pooed by the Republicans and sort of suggested and marginalized for that. But then I read this paper, Lindsay, and I'm like, maybe I made the wrong connection, because I was trying to do it to support the idea that we need to address climate change. But given after I read what you were writing, it seems to me that they're using climate change as another angle to sort of redefine how they expand and approach their military budget. So let's talk a little bit about my misunderstanding of what their agenda is. I thought that they were sobering us up to address climate change. And now I feel like maybe not. So Lindsay, if you'd like to begin, I would love to get your response.
Yeah, thanks, Arnie. Well, first of all, congratulations on your influence over Martin O'Malley. I'm from that neck of the woods, originally from Maryland, where he is also now still, since he didn't become president. But yeah, so it's, we know that the Pentagon is taking climate change seriously. And even under this administration, they're recognizing the threat. They are not climate science deniers, despite what the rest of this administration may be doing. And they've been recognizing the reality of climate change for decades now. So really on the early side. But what we also know is that where the Pentagon sees a problem, they see a military solution. Every single time when they see a problem, the answer to that problem is always more military. And climate change is no exception. And so what we see from the Pentagon, when we see them talking about climate change and how we'll address this crisis, is not primarily about shifting to clean energy sources. It's not primarily about, you know, insulating people who will be the most affected, which are brown and black and poor people all over the world. But what we see from them is really talking about building up America as a fortress. And my colleague Laura unearthed a really terrifying Pentagon report from, I think, about 2003, where it was quite frank that they were talking about we were going to build walls to keep migrants out and keep resources within the United States of America for the people currently living in the United States of America. And of course, that's exactly what we're seeing now.
So Laura, what I'm getting from the report that I read was that, so they understand climate change. They understand that it will have enormous consequences. It will cause incredible unrest. It will cover incredible shifting of populations, not just within the United States, but around the world, and that the level of instability is horrific. So instead of saying, so maybe we should mitigate climate change, so maybe we should look at what are the underlying causes of climate change, they want to accept climate change as the reality and not address it. And therefore, if it's the reality, now they're looking for new ways of addressing the instability. So their goal is to figure out how to play with instability, not how to lessen instability. I mean, it just makes, and what I thought was so interesting, and one of the things in the report was, you actually quoted from Elizabeth Warren, who says to the Pentagon, we want you to use more fuel efficiency. We want you to use clean energy. We want you, and like, that's a nice thing, because they are big polluters. There's no question about it. But what Elizabeth Warren is still kind of suggesting is, but it's okay for you to continue to have a military response to something that probably doesn't deserve a military response, but really deserves a climate response or an environmental response. So in a lot of ways, she's almost feeding in to what they really want, which is an increased budget to respond in a military way. Am I right, Laura?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think we see more and more people taking notice that the United States military is a huge polluter and a huge contributor to the climate crisis. And the response from some, like you said, including Elizabeth Warren, is claims that we can green the military or make it more environmentally sustainable. But what we know is that in reality, that's really not possible. Senator Warren's plan to green the military sought to achieve net zero emissions for all of its non-combat bases and infrastructure by 2030, which sounds great on the surface, but in reality, that's only addressing a pretty small fraction of the fossil fuel consumption and emissions associated with the military. That plan excludes, for example, emissions required to send troops, weaponry, supplies to, you know, the more than 800 military bases around the globe, which takes place almost constantly. And so besides the fact that plans to green the military completely disregard all the other problematic operations of the military and really do nothing to address the violent and destructive nature of the military, but they're also just not really possible at achieving these green ambitions.
Could I just pipe in? Is there a reason why you couldn't do all these things? I was going to say, when Lindsay was talking about militaries worrying about people coming across the borders because of climate insecurity and feeling the need to protect the homeland and deal with the migratory aspect of the climate crisis, that is something that needs to be taken into account. I don't mean we're so great that we should protect ourselves from bad people, but migratory moves and how that affects different countries needs to be thought about. And likewise with Elizabeth Warren, if you're going to have any military doing anything, it should do it not using up more fossil fuels in one airplane flight than 7 years worth of an automobile.
Lindsay, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, so of course we need to address climate migration. We know that it's going to be a really big problem in the years ahead. It's already a problem. We know that there are already migration flows that are being driven in part by droughts that are climate driven and by, you know, other, you know, severe storms that are climate driven. So we're seeing this already, but in the coming years, it's going to get worse. And by one relatively modest estimate, we'll see 200 million climate refugees. And so these are significant problems, right? And a lot of this is part of what's driving nationalism that we see around the world right now. We do need to have solutions in place, but those solutions can't be military solutions. You know, we need to have humanitarian solutions. We need to have international agreements on where migrants can be safely relocated. And none of that is made better by having a bigger military infrastructure, especially when having that bigger military infrastructure usually antagonizes other countries that we will need to work these agreements out with.
Right. And let me, I want to go back to some of the key findings that you had in this report, because I think it's important to sort of go through the bullets, because in a lot of ways, it just reinforces this conversation. We began with the fact that the Pentagon is a major polluter. All right. We just talked about, you know, Elizabeth Warren wanting to now green them up. And then this is the one that makes me totally crazy. The United States has a well-known history of fighting wars for not oranges, but oil. So in a lot of ways, the raison d'etre, why did we go to war in Iraq? Oh, it's going to pay for itself. With what? With the oil. I mean, it's, you know, you look over and over again, and there is a natural resource connection to these wars. And that natural resource usually tends to be the biggest polluters that we're trying to protect. And then you point out that climate change and border militarization are inextricably linked. Overinvestment in the military comes at a high cost of underinvestment in other needs, including climate. Workers need a way out, and racism and racial oppression form the foundation for both the extractive fossil fuel economy and the militarized economy. So as I'm looking at your report, I want to go back to something when I was a young woman running for higher office. And I remember that there was sort of this idea that men were good on the hard issues. They were good on the economy, and they were good on the military budgets, and they understood foreign policy. And those girls, they were good on the soft issues, you know, like healthcare and the environment and the food supply and education. And I'm looking at what's happening now in 2020. So, ladies, let's be honest here. It turns out that the hard stuff that those guys were good at, that's not what's taken us to our knees. Our inability to respond to a healthcare crisis, our inability to have a public health system, our inability to pay people at a reasonable wage, our inability to have a protected environment, all those things now are making us vulnerable. Isn't this the absolute perfect time to talk about redefining what is security? I mean, that's what this is about. Supposedly, the whole raison d'etre for the military is to provide us with security. And I've got to start questioning, what kind of security? You know, because what they're building bombs for and, you know, what they want to drop with the way of a nuke isn't what's really sort of frightening us. It's that little virus that, you know, Donald Trump keeps referring to. He wants to be a war president, but look what he's fighting. He isn't fighting anything that they built at the Pentagon. He's fighting something that happens in nature. So, I mean, I'm just looking at all this and I'm thinking, isn't this the time where what you are writing about has to be almost what we need to be addressing after the 2020 election? Because security has now got to be redefined.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you hit the nail on the head with that one. I mean, I think what's incredibly obvious is that funneling trillions of dollars into the U.S. military obviously isn't making the American people any safer, and that the big national security issues that we're facing right now are not solved by military solutions. Issues like climate change, the global pandemic we're facing currently, funneling tons of money into the military hasn't prepared us to address these global crises. And so I think this really reinforces, like you were saying, the urgent need to change the way that we use our federal resources. And instead of investing in an economy of war, we really need to invest in an infrastructure of care.
So Lindsay, as we're looking at this and we're looking at how we have the blown up deficit because of Donald Trump's tax cuts, and now we're going to have a blown up deficit because the economy is at the worst point it's ever been in its history. It's going to make the crash of 29 look like a walk in the park, in part because people could go out to work. Right now, everyone is being told the economy is crashing and don't move. I mean, just like, you know, so it seems to me that because we need to reconfigure our investment, because we realize that the pandemic is kind of a precursor to climate change, that it's time to sort of reacquaint ourselves with not only how much money we are spending in the Pentagon and the amount of money that we keep sending into the military industrial complex, but that now the Pentagon is actually undermining our security. It is not making us safer, Lindsay. It is making us less safe. I think if there's a time to beat that freaking drum, now is the time to do it. Because when you look at what we don't have available to actually make people feel like they have a future, and then you look at the Pentagon budget, where money does definitely go to die, and you realize that it's not a bomber or a nuke that I need. It's a doctor. You know, it's a vaccine.
Right.
It's a minimum wage. And I think that in a bizarre way, you have the perfect opportunity to sort of reassess what it is we have and what it is we're spending on.
That's right, Arnie. I mean, one thing that is crystal clear and much clearer to a lot of people right now is that our priorities have been all wrong. This has been a problem for a long time. It's gotten worse in recent years under this administration. On February 10th, the Trump administration put out their budget proposal. This was, remember, after the coronavirus was a known entity, after they knew that it would come here and that we would have to deal with it. They proposed funding Trump's Space Force, which is a pet project that is absolutely unnecessary for national security under any reasonable scenario. It would have allowed Trump to continue to siphon money, billions of dollars from the Pentagon for his border wall. So it funded his pet projects at the same time that it proposed cutting the CDC by 32%. So these are the priorities that we've been seeing, and we're seeing loud and clear that if we don't change our priorities, things are not going to get better. And all of the underlying problems that are making the coronavirus so difficult are the same underlying problems that will make climate so difficult if we don't deal with them.
Well, I think we're losing you a little bit. So Laura, as I'm listening to Lindsay talking about the priorities, I'm looking at going into 2020. It seems to me, I know that running for president is not a time to educate, that people are so concerned and they're worried about the uncertainty of the future. But I think that in a funny way, because we are sort of stuck in place, because we are so frightened about the future, because we look at our own sort of the health consequences of this pandemic and the instability of the economy as it provides security for our families, for our state, for our community, this would be a great time to talk about the Pentagon budget. This would be a great time to redefine what is meant by security. But my biggest frustration is that Democrats are not much better than Republicans on this. In part because, you know, the military-industrial complex still kind of controls the conversation we have. Because there's so much money swirling around politics, because they're able to sort of have greater influence because of the revolving door, because of all these things. But I really do think that now is the time to exhibit courage, because while they may be able to sort of cut checks, what they can't do is make people feel more safe. And I think if people understood what was going into this budget and what was basically undermining their stability, you would actually be able to protect the politicians who really want to talk truth to power. Because right now, I think they're more than willing to maybe even risk hearing the truth.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what you're getting at is that people really don't realize the massive detriment that having this huge amount of money funneled into the military every year causes for everyone. And, you know, what we talk about in the report is that enormous and unnecessary military expenditures have really warped our sense of what's possible, and they've really tricked us into believing that we can't afford the things that we really need to improve our lives, to keep us safe, and to really keep the planet livable. And so I think you're right. I think this is a critical moment to examine where our federal resources are going and really see that we really do have enough money and enough resources to fund the programs that we need to be safe.
So Lindsay, I'm thinking about Donald Trump. He's a war president, and what is he fighting? He's fighting a virus.
Yes.
And then we talk about the fact that he hates China. What's he hate China about? Trade. Yes. And then, so think of all the things he's using. He uses warlike terms, but what we're fighting doesn't require a military response. Think about that. So in a bizarre way, as I'm looking at this project that you're working on, again, I'm going to read that back. Fighting for a U.S. federal budget that prioritizes peace, economic security, and shared prosperity. I'm going to make a suggestion. I think you need to use some of Donald Trump's words against him, because he keeps talking about the fact that he's a war president, and I think you need to remind people what he's fighting. And I think when he, you know, talks about China being the enemy, I think you need to remind people what he's fighting, because he's not fighting a military fight the way we think of a military, with soldiers and a bomb and a nuke and whatever. What he is fighting is economic policy. What he is fighting is health policy. What he is fighting is climate change. And to a large extent, in order to reinforce what you've written in this fabulous, fabulous project that we've done here, is that you really are able to use even his words to say, guess what? If you listen to Donald Trump, every dollar that he sent to the Pentagon doesn't address all the issues he says he's fighting. He's fighting. And I think in a bizarre way, that not only sort of castrates him, which I kind of like to do, but it also sort of gives courage to Democrats to be able to talk about it in a way where people can hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're getting a lot clearer on what things we need to be worried about in this country. And there's been a lot of fear and a lot of fear mongering around a lot of things that are not deserving of our fear. We don't need to be worried about a war with China. We don't need to be worried about attacks from other countries. What we need to be worried about really is things like this virus and the deep economic inequality that we're seeing just devastate people. All of which was, all of these underlying issues were here before, and they are going to stay with us unless we change what we're doing.
Not to mention climate change.
Yeah, not to mention climate change. But I want to remind everyone that there's another problem with the military-industrial complex, and that for a lot of senators and a lot of members of Congress, the military budget is a job program. Okay, that's what it is. I'm going to bring back the bucks to Boeing. I'm going to bring back the bucks to Raytheon. I'm going to bring back the bucks to Lockheed Sanders, whatever it is, BIE system. And I think even as you talk about this, and you want politicians to be able to talk about it so that we can reprioritize our dollars and our economy and not fund the Pentagon, but fund other things, I think that as we describe it, we have to begin to say, what can Raytheon do from a jobs perspective that isn't a bomb, okay? What can Boeing do that from a jobs perspective? And again, what we know, I mean, that's what's so scary to me, is that we're not going to see us maybe using the airplane industry in the same way. And Boeing is going to say, oh, but we still may need a bomber. You know what I mean? So they're going to look at it. So we have to, I think, both understand the jobs perspective of the military budget, because that really has been, for a lot of members of Congress and the Senate, a bread and butter issue. And we have to sort of say, we need to reprioritize, but we also understand that we need to also then send those dollars back in a job way, but don't make these things, because these things make us less safe. Am I right, Laura? I think that's the other thing we have. It's such a complex issue. It's not just about sending another dollar to a different direction. It's recognizing who's attached to that dollar. And it's not just Raytheon, it's the people that work at Raytheon.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's a lot to learn from the climate justice movement in this conversation. Yes. People that have been working to transform our energy sector for decades have talked a lot about what a just transition for people and communities that are dependent on the fossil fuel industry for jobs. And so I think we need to have a similar conversation as it relates to transitioning out of a war economy.
Absolutely. So we have to start checking off the jobs that we're going to create by reducing the Pentagon budget. We're not reducing investment. We're actually making investment in security. We're still producing jobs, all those things. Just the difference is we will actually be able to feel more safe and more secure moving forward. The title of their piece, No Warming, No War, How Militarism Fuels the Climate Crisis and Vice Versa. Laura Steichen and Lindsay Kashgarian from the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. I would love to see Joe Biden talk about this. I may have to wait a while.
From your mouth to his ears.
Oh, yeah, really.
I know. I'll whisper it in his ear, I promise. Thank you, ladies, so much for joining us.
So,
it's a pleasure.
Are you folks related to that just economy or whatever words you use, Laura, Lindsay? Is that part of your project?
Just transition?
Just transition, yeah. Is that part of your group as well?
It's not an organization. Laura, do you want to talk? It's sort of a concept. Laura, do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, there certainly are some entire organizations that are sort of dedicated to this concept of a just transition, but it's something that sort of started with relationships between folks in the climate justice space and the labor movement and has now sort of taken on this broader meaning that we also use in the report.
Yeah, because political economists have been talking about, you know, transitioning from a military economy to a peacetime economy, or transitioning from a factory economy to jobs that are going to be available for people that used to work in factories, as well as the climate.
It's going to be so interesting. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And yes, you can thank me for Martin O'Malley, but I was still like, but after reading your report, I went, oh, what did I do? Thank you so much. Ciao. Talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye.
Good work.
Sam, how do you do? Give me five. I'm still alive. Ain't no luck. I learned to duck. Check my pulse. It don't change. Stay 72. Shine or rain, wave the flag, pop the bag, bark the boat, skin the goat. Change your act.